This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure for me to have back in the studio the great sports writer Dave Zirin, one of the best journalists of his generation. Zirin's the author of A People's History of Sports in the United States and several other related books. He hosts Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM. You might have seen him on ESPN or Rachel Maddow. And he's got a terrific new film out called Not Just a Game, Power, Politics, and American Sports. Not least, of course, he's the monthly sports columnist for the Progressive Magazine. Dave Zirin, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. Can I just quote you or maybe take a recording of that and carry it around with me, particularly to family functions?
Put it on a business card, will you?
Sounds good.
Why the film?
Oh, my goodness. I'll tell you why the film. Because I love telling stories, and I wrote this book, A People's History of Sports in the United States, and I love the idea of these hidden histories. You know, I'm a student of Howard Zinn, not a literal student as in I sat in his classroom, but a student like so many other of the millions of people who read A People's History of the United States and fell in love with the idea of social history, fell in love with the idea of what's sometimes called micro-labor history, the real individual stories that so often either get completely hidden from public view, or they get completely denuded. The canines, if you will, get extracted by the political dentists performing a kind of right wing root canal
without anesthesia.
Without anesthesia, let's take the metaphor and just beat it to death. Now, for me, I love telling these stories, and the folks at the Media Education Foundation, an incredible nonprofit filmmaking group out of Amherst, Massachusetts, they came up with this idea and said, "Why don't we take some of these stories and actually show the clips to back them up?" Like, let's not just tell people about Muhammad Ali. Let's show Muhammad Ali making political speeches, not just
boxing. So they came to you? You didn't go to them?
No, they came to me. And they said, "We love your stuff. Let's really try to bring it to life in a different kind of a way." And, you know, I liked the idea. It sounded like a good idea. And I have to tell you that the gap between my expectations and the actual product is bigger than B.J. Raji. I mean, it's a huge – that would be the huge nose tackle for the Packers for those who aren't sports fans out there. But, I mean, I'm so happy with the final product of the film. The use of clips, of music, of never-before-seen speeches. I mean, they really do an amazing job of telling this history in a way that I think grabs the listener and grabs the viewer in an entirely different kind of way.
Yeah, I just saw it for the first time last night, and I want to tell the listener who is in her office or who's in his kitchen or who's driving to work right now or to the grocery store that if you have a kid of any age, you know, under 25 maybe, as my oldest kid is, who is interested in athletics or is an athlete herself or himself, this is the film for them, not just a game, Power, Politics, and American Sports, because it opens a huge lens on this otherwise just masked field, which is the intersection of sports and politics, and that's where Dave Zirin has set up shop here professionally at that intersection for the last.
And let's be clear, it's the good, the bad, and the ugly of the intersection of politics and sports, and that's one of the things I really like about the choices we made in terms of what to include into this 62-minute film.
I love some of the footage you had, some of the stories you told. I didn't know some of these stories. I read the book on People's History of Sports in the U.S., so I knew some of the stories. But the runners, for instance,
yeah.
Women runners, tell a couple of those stories.
Ooh, I mean, the story of Kathy Switzer is one I'm really glad was in there because it's not a story that's well-known. Kathy Switzer was the first female runner in the Boston Marathon. And this did not occur in 1947 or 1957. It was 1967. The Boston Marathon was an all-male race until 1967. And Kathy Switzer only got in the race because she registered as K.V. Switzer. And people assumed that she was a man. And so she gets in the race and she's running. And one of the Boston Marathon organizers drove up alongside her in a flatbed truck, jumped out of the back of the truck, physically grabbed her and yelled, "Get the hell out of my race." And some of the male runners running alongside her physically defended Kathy Switzer. And in the midst of all this scrum, she never broke stride and just kept running. And the images that took place that day were broadcast around the world, showing two very different ideas of masculinity and femininity in the world of sports. There's the threatened masculinity of a woman daring to be in a race and the idea that you will physically assault a woman for daring to run in the Boston Marathon. And then other runners who said, wait a minute, this is another athlete. She deserves the respect all of us get. And through all of this madness, Kathy Switzer just focused on putting one foot ahead of the other for 26 miles.
And how did you know to go get that footage, or did the people at the Media Education Foundation know to get that footage?
Oh, I mean, honestly, it was one of those things where we just had a huge pile of ideas on a table. And it was like, what are we going to include in this 62-minute film? And that necessitated making some very hard, painful choices, because I think a movie about sports and politics could get the Eyes on the Prize treatment. 15 volumes, 2 hours each. The Ken Burns treatment, if you will.
No guitar or banjo, though.
Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. Without the drippy politics, like Ken Burns without the gooiness. But I think that there really is potential for a huge film series like that. But for something like this, we had to make some very tough choices, and we like the Switzer story because, unlike a story about, say, Billie Jean King, Jackie Robinson, or Muhammad Ali, it's not the case of saying, hey, you may know this person, but you don't know the hidden history of who this person was. You don't know that Billie Jean King came from a working class background and built the first ever women's sports union. You don't know that Jackie Robinson became a real firebrand for the civil rights movement late in life. You don't know that Muhammad Ali made these amazing speeches about war and poverty. And with Kathy Switzer, it was, you don't know this person at all.
Right.
And we wanted to make sure that was a part of the film as well.
I mean, the combination, Dave Zirin, of having both the really famous people and the unknown people is a very powerful part. And just sticking with women track athletes, I mean, you go back to where women were excluded from the Olympic track.
Yes.
That's a story I didn't know either. Tell that.
Yeah. Well, in 1928, the women's 800 meters was banned from the Olympics for 30 years after the pictures came out across the globe of women falling to the ground after the race. I mean, it doesn't seem like that big a deal. I mean, you run 800 meters against the best runners on earth, and you become physically exhausted afterwards. You see that with male runners all the time.
I was going to say, guys have been known to do that.
Yes. The sight of women falling to the ground after the race sent the International Olympic Committee, which has always been an organization of stodgy aristocrats and quasi-fascists and royalists, into a frenzy. And they canceled women out of that particular event for 30 years. And during those 30 years, and actually well into the 1950s, there were significant members in the International Olympic Committee who believed very strongly that women's track and field should be abolished altogether, that African-American women should be abolished from running in track and field. I mean, there's a very nasty undercurrent to how the Olympics have chosen to organize.
And you quote a New York Times sports writer, probably was a famous sports writer.
Oh, he was a Pulitzer Prize winner,
really?
Arthur Daly, yeah.
And what did he say?
Well, he wrote a column where he compared women to, he said, the Amazons, and he said there is nothing physically appealing about seeing perspiration drip from a fair lady's alabaster brow. I mean, just the kind of, and he goes, it's probably boorish to say it, but no woman could ever beat any self-respecting schoolboy in any kind of athletic endeavor. And you read the words now, and first of all, you wonder how they were ever published.
Right.
And the second thing that you see is just how threatened a whole generation of men were at the idea of women taking part in sport. And that raises another question. Why? What in the world is so threatening about sport? I mean, I think we ask these questions about a lot of things, like what's so dangerous about sharing a water fountain with somebody who has a different color skin than you? I mean, we look back on these things like, what was the big deal? But the big deal, it wasn't about just being able to run a race, just like it wasn't just about being able to drink from a water fountain. It was about the idea of equality and access. That's what was so threatening, because sports is the vivid demonstration that, you know what, maybe there isn't these huge biological differences between men and women, between black people and white people. Maybe there actually is a lot more equality than people want to admit. And sports has a way of demonstrating that with electric ability. And I think that's really what frightens people in power.
Speaking with Dave Zirin, who's the author of this book, A People's History of Sports in the U.S., and it's been turned into an incredible, powerful film, Not Just a Game, Power, Politics, and American Sports. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Dave, how would people get a hold of this film?
Go to the Media Education Foundation website. If you are with a school or any kind of academic institution, please purchase it at the academic price. It's what allows the Media Education Foundation to exist. Now, if you are an individual person who you got a kid who plays sports, you can go to the website and register as a home user, and that drops the price of the film dramatically. And if you have any questions about it, just call the phone number of the Media Education Foundation. They are prepared to deal with this because they understand that this film really isn't just about something that'll be shown in colleges as a classroom aid. It's got a much more popular appeal than that.
Sticking with this sexism and sports theme just for a little bit longer, Billie Jean King, as you mentioned, is in the film. Have you had an opportunity to talk with her? And if so, what's she like?
Ooh, Billie Jean King. I mean, you're talking about somebody here who understands the importance of labor in the context of sports. That's something a lot of people really don't realize about Billie Jean King. We mentioned it briefly in the film, but she's the daughter of a firefighter. She grew up practicing on public courts, and tennis has always been a country club sport, but it wasn't for Billie Jean King. And because of that, she always was somebody who fought for pay equity every step of the way, the first ever founder of a women's sports union. And when I spoke with her, we talked about her role in the – we spoke about this off air, Matt, but her role in with the 1996 women's Olympic soccer team, and that they weren't even getting equal meal money to the men's soccer team, even though they were gold medal favorites and the men's were just awful. Just
and that's
a terrible
just unbelievable.
Team. Yeah, not even getting – yeah, the same amount for sustenance. And so who do they turn to figure out what to do? The captains of the team, people like Julie Foudy and Brianna Scurry and Mia Hamm, they turn to Billie Jean King, which is great if you just think about the way our society has so much historical amnesia. It's a great sign that in women's sports you do have a kind of historical continuity and understanding and respect for the people who came before you. And they contacted Billie Jean King and they said, what do we do? And Billie Jean King said, walk away. Time to wildcat this thing.
And did they do that?
Yes, and the U.S. Olympic Committee brought in an entire SCAB team to replace them, but they later did settle and get that equal money to the men's team. So it worked.
The film shows Billie Jean King with the famous Bobby Riggs Battle of the Sexes, which I figured would be in there. But then the discussion of her coming out I thought was real interesting, and I had forgotten that she paid a big price for that.
Huge price for that. And it's the sort of thing where the issue of commercial credibility really came into play, because people forget that after Billie Jean King beat Bobby Riggs in the Battle of the Sexes match, she was a very hot property commercially. I mean, the Battle of the Sexes match is still one of the five highest rated sports programs in the history of the United States.
I remember watching it with a little study in my family's home.
Yeah. The percentage of televisions in use to watch that were just off the chain. And Billie Jean King was then the person who was the pitch lady of choice as the new strong woman. But the new strong woman had to be a strong, married, straight woman. And so when it came out that she was having a lesbian relationship with her assistant, especially – we didn't talk about this in the film, but you know, her given name is Billie Jean Moffitt. And when it came out that this was part of an open understanding with her husband, who she was still very close to, that just was not something that corporate America wanted to have anything to do with. And she was ostracized for years and years and years. And you don't see a reemergence of Billie Jean King for about a decade until Martina Navratilova emerged as such a dominant force and had her partner there in the family section at Wimbledon in the mid-1980s, which for me growing up, that was kind of a radicalizing experience.
And Martina was brave in her own right too.
Oh, absolutely. As someone who came out of the closet very early, as somebody who also spoke out against not just the repression of the Eastern Bloc, which she defected from, but then I remember when Newt Gingrich won in 1994 and became Speaker of the House, she said, I left East Germany to get away from people like this. So she has never shied away from speaking out on issues of political repression. Me too. And you know, one of the bravest things she ever said was something that I think that she got a tremendous amount of criticism for. And looking back, I'm still stunned at her bravery. When Magic Johnson announced that he was HIV positive in 1991 and then made a huge point of saying that he had never had any sort of gay sex whatsoever, that he got it because he had indiscriminately had unprotected sex with countless numbers of women. And implied in that is like, did he infect other people? Was he an irresponsible partner? She came out and she said, why is it that the media finds it far more palatable that he had this incredibly irresponsible heterosexual life as opposed to if he happened to be in a gay relationship and get HIV? Mm. And people crushed her for saying that. And it was actually this very brave media critique at that time.
Yeah, she's just a tremendous political person, obviously incredible athlete, inspiring for me and my family. On this theme of homophobia, there is a shocking line in your film, Dave Zirin. The film is not just a game, Power, Politics, and American Sports. I can't recommend it highly enough. There's a line that says there's no current athlete in the big three male sports who has come out.
As an active player.
Right.
There have been,
athlete. Yeah.
There have been, you can count the number on one hand who have come out after retirement, but none have come out while playing.
And that's shocking to me in 2011.
It speaks to something, and it speaks to the way that athletics have been this hamlet of homophobia. Now, I see this changing, but I see it changing from the bottom up. I see it changing at the high school level. I see it changing at the collegiate level, where at some of the small colleges you're seeing some football players have come out.
Yeah, I don't know if it's happening in high school football, though.
Yeah, it has happened, though.
Really?
Yeah, in Western Mass, and in a couple other examples as well. And you know what it depends on? I'm a big believer, Matt, and you hear me say this before, but I'm a big believer that sports is like a hammer, and you could use a hammer to build a house or bash somebody over the head. When you have a football program, even football with all its machismo and homoeroticism and homophobia, which is all there, and I'm a big football fan, but it's all there as a part of the American experience of professional football. When you have a coach who uses sports like a hammer to build a house, they will address the fact that there is a gay teammate in a way that's positive, that's life-affirming, and that brings a team closer together. That's what happened in Western Mass. When the player went to his coach and said, I'm gay, I assume this means I'm off the team, I've packed up my stuff, and the coach said, hell no, we're gonna stay together and we're gonna bring the whole team in on this and figure this out as a team. When that happens, really profound things happen. And what's so interesting to me is that it replicates the story of Jackie Robinson and other African-American players integrating locker rooms, and how players were really forced to confront their own assumptions.
It's a great story. It reminds me, my son's football coach, who was kind of Neanderthal as far as politics go, but a really decent guy and who liked kids. My son was on a team where one of my son's best friends on the team's house got foreclosed on, and the coach made the kids go help him move to an apartment. So
wow,
that was a great story too.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting a little choked up just saying.
I get choked up these days. I'm getting old and sentimental.
You're getting sentimental.
Getting old and sentimental. Dave Zirin, I want you to talk about corporatization in sports, because it's you've got Muhammad Ali, who is the antithesis of a corporate sellout, and then you have the thesis of a corporate sellout, who is Michael Jordan. That's quite an arc.
Yes, and they're joined at the hip in so many ways, because at the end of the 20th century, that was the big debate in every major sports publication, is who is the athlete of the century? And it was Babe Ruth, was always number three. And then the big question became, do you have Michael Jordan 2 or Muhammad Ali 2? Michael Jordan 1 or Muhammad Ali 1? And it was, I thought, a tremendously telling statement when ESPN, which is the most powerful force in sports, made that decision to say Michael Jordan is number one and Muhammad Ali is number two. Now, in their minor defense, they were saying that in the glow of Jordan's recent retirement and his obvious place at the apex of sports in that hyper-commercialized moment at the turn of the century. And, you know, of course, Muhammad Ali at that point had really lost the power of speech. So that you could maybe argue they were being a little bit impressionistic, but I think it was more a statement that they respected Michael Jordan's corporate power more than Muhammad Ali's rebellious power. And I think even at 2011, just 11 years later, it's already obvious in hindsight that they made a terrible mistake as far as who was more influential. And we could say this in a number of ways. Like, first of all, go anywhere in the global South. Go to any open-air market and look at what the knockoff T-shirts are. At every one that I've been to, you always see two people. One is Bruce Lee and the other is Muhammad Ali. You don't see Michael Jordan. Maybe you did 10 years ago. You don't now. And the second thing is I heard this old athlete speaking on ESPN about how he doesn't get the chills anymore because he's met so many famous people over the years. And they said, are you trying to tell me you wouldn't get the chills if you saw Michael Jordan? And the guy said, honestly, not really. I mean, who's Michael Jordan to me? And they said, so you wouldn't get the chills if Muhammad Ali walked in here right now? And there's this silence. And he said, ooh, yeah, that would do it. I love that story.
Yeah, me too. Dave Zirin is my guest today on Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You mentioned ESPN, and I saw you on a panel last night say that ESPN has this thing, and I didn't know about it. I guess I'm not watching ESPN enough, that just says Shut Up, or the Shut Up Award. What is that about?
Well, it's their they're very widely listened to morning radio program. It's called Mike and Mike in the Morning. Very entertaining banter between sort of like a big, gruff ex-football player, Mike Golic, and a proudly metrosexual, Mike Greenberg, and it allows them to play on all kinds of archetypes, like the bully and the sissy and all kinds of things, and I'm sure they're very proud of that they perpetuate that. But one of the things they do on the show is what they call the Just Shut Up Award, and it's about people in the world of sports, usually athletes, who say things that they shouldn't say. And I'll never forget when they gave the Just Shut Up Award to Barry Bonds, the retired slugger with allegations of steroids have swirled around him for years with the San Francisco Giants. And Barry Bonds, about 6 years ago, he was still playing, was really being asked again and again, have you used steroids, use steroids, use steroids? And his response to the reporters after being very frustrated is, how can you live with yourself asking me about steroids and not trying to talk about Hurricane Katrina? This is like right after Katrina
hit. And they didn't want to hear about Hurricane Katrina.
That got him the Just Shut Up Award.
God,
and that's a great example of how it's used. It's like, wait a minute. That breaks what is meant to be the narrative here, which is A, this is a sports show. We don't talk about Katrina. And B, you're a dumb jock. Who the hell are you to have anything to say about Hurricane Katrina? So, I mean, this is in the film. We call people like this who do things like the Just Shut Up Award, we call them the keepers of normality. I mean, they mine that flame.
And the film is not just a game, Power, Politics, and American Sports. Dave Zirin is the narrator of the film. It's kind of the film version of his great book, A People's History of Sports in the U.S. You can get it at the Media Education Foundation. And your life's work is really to counter the Just Shut Up Awards of this world.
Absolutely. And people ask me sometimes, because I am politically very comfortably left of center, people ask me sometimes like, oh, do you just support left-wing athletes? You don't support right-wing athletes? So there's hypocrisy there. And let me just be very clear about this. I'm for all athletes being able to exercise their freedom of speech. And my big problem right now is that the wheel has turned so far in the other direction that even daring to speak out is transgressive. So I'm for letting it loose. I'm for not treating athletes as if they're people with muscles and ligaments and tendons and cartilage, but not brains. I think it sends a terrible message to young people because, you know, I used to teach elementary school, Matt, when I got out of college. And what I learned is that athletes are role models whether we want them to be or not. That's just a fact. And what's also a fact is 0.0001% of kids in our schools are ever going to grow up to be professional athletes. So then we have to ask ourselves the question, what is it that they are role modeling? What are they modeling? And if they're modeling, hey, if you're an athletic superstar, then you lead this glamorized, glorified life, or if they're modeling money matters and corporate power matters above all else, that's really destructive. Like Michael Jordan. But if they're modeling being a political and informed citizen is really the aspiration that people should try to reach, and look at me, I'm risking my possible benefits and privileges because I care about the world, that's actually incredibly productive and incredibly constructive.
Is there an athlete today who speaks out more than anybody else that you can point to?
Well, I'm very excited about an athlete named Adrian Gonzalez, and he's the new first baseman for the Boston Red Sox. He just got a mammoth free agent contract, and now that he's been an all-star multiple times, and he's still in his late 20s, but people haven't really heard about him too much because he played for the San Diego Padres. Well, Adrian Gonzalez, who was born in the United States, is an outspoken believer in immigrant rights. He's somebody, even though he's a multiple all-star, has claimed that he will boycott the 2011 All-Star Game if it plays in Arizona, where Arizona, of course, has passed these horribly draconian anti-immigration laws, not just against immigrants, but against things like ethnic studies and actually teaching people about their own history. And Adrian Gonzalez has spoken out about that. And when he was in San Diego, he was very active in the community. He was very active in trying to help people who are called the border migrants, the people who risk their lives to cross that part of the border between Mexico and the United States. So I'm excited to see what Adrian does now that he has this huge media spotlight. And of course, what we know is it could mean the opposite too, especially now that he got this huge contract. But hey, it's not the NFL, it's baseball. That means guaranteed money. So that could also maybe free him up to speak more too.
Yeah, I should hope so. One thing about your movie also that's stunning to me, the movie Not Just a Game, Power, Politics, and American Sports, I'm with Dave Zirin, is the illustration of the grotesque militarization of sports.
Sure.
Never more so than in this piece of footage you got from Fox where Terry Bradshaw and the boys are over in Afghanistan in uniform.
Yeah, they're dressed in current 21st century military camouflage, running their pregame show, doing these puff piece specials about how the relationship between the U.S. military and the NFL has always been a strong one. You know, they do those incredibly obnoxious inflections to their voice. And then it cuts to the person doing the story. And this woman, Pam Oliver, she says, the relationship between the U.S. military and football has always been a strong one. And it's like, okay, I'm glad you all have your talking points down. That's great. But it's grotesque. And we showed it in the film, particularly because at that particular pregame show from Afghanistan, they inaugurated the Pat Tillman USO Center. Pat Tillman, the former NFL player who became an Army Ranger and then died under very murky circumstances, and his family has been trying for years to find out the truth around the circumstances of his death. And Pat Tillman as well turned against the war in Iraq during his last years on this earth. And they make no effort, Fox and the NFL, to talk about any of these complicated aspects of Pat Tillman's story. All they do is use his name to inaugurate a USO center, which is in effect a way to use the NFL to sell the military and to sell war, something Pat Tillman would have absolutely despised.
Yeah, you quote some people who were in the army or in the military with him who just said he would have just said this is a farce, this is hideous.
Yeah, he would have hated it. And Pat Tillman was always more useful to Donald Rumsfeld and the Pentagon in death than he was in life.
He was risky in life. He was a critic. He wanted to meet Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, he wanted to meet Noam Chomsky. But even before, because remember, he joined right after 9/11, before the incursion into Iraq. So even before that, which seems to be what was the tipping point for him in turning against the military adventures abroad, the Army approached him several times about being a sort of army of one recruit. Because remember, recruiting numbers dipped dramatically after 9/11, particularly in the African-American community. And they wanted Pat Tillman to do commercials. And he refused to do it and insisted on being an anonymous soldier.
So even before he turned against the Iraq War, which he did decisively, he was still not going to play ball with the military recruiters.
Yeah, he was very troubled by everything that happened also in Iraq. He followed very closely what happened with Jessica Lynch. And he was down there when that all went down. And he saw – and this is exposed brilliantly in a very good documentary called The Tillman Story, which people should also watch. And he was very appalled by seeing, let's call it the media wing of the military-industrial complex in action, and he wanted no part of it.
Unfortunately, he's still a part of it.
Isn't that something?
Unbelievable. What a desecration. Mm-hmm. We're out of time, unfortunately. Dave Zirin's been my guest today. He's the author of A People's History of Sports in the U.S. You can listen to his Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM. Got to get his film, Not Just a Game, Power, Politics, and American Sports. And you can get it at the Media Education Foundation website. Dave Zirin, thanks so much for being my guest.
My privilege. Can I stay for your rant?
Sure, you can wait for my rant, and everyone can listen to my rant at progressive.org.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.